Hello, science enthusiasts. My name is Jason Zukowski, and your host. I'm a high school chemistry teacher, but you probably know our dog, Bunsen Burner. He's the Twitter science dog. This show takes what's best about Bunsen's account, the science and empathy found there, and spins it into podcast form. Every week, you'll learn some new science in our science news section. We'll also talk about some really interesting dog or pet science. Every week, there's an amazing expert that is interviewed, and we get to learn so much from them. And we end the podcast with stories and trivia. This is the Science Podcast. Hey, how's everybody doing out there? I can't believe this is the fifth episode of season two. This week I was teaching teachers actually how to get kids excited about science. I ran a whole bunch of sessions. One of them was about explosions and fire, and the other one was using my unbreakable bubble solution. I also got to talk to teachers about the podcast, how they could start a podcast learning from my mistakes and the things that I do and how they could use it in their classroom. I also talked about the story of how this podcast started. I think it was pretty well received. The week this podcast is being recorded, Adam's been off. We've had this weird kind of break called winter break, where the teachers have teachers' convention and professional development for most of it, and the kids have a week off school. Score for the kids, kind of bummer for the teachers. That's okay, though, because professional development sometimes can be really fun. My leg is completely healed, and I guess my injury jumped into Chris, because now she did something to her leg and her foot. So she might talk about that in the family section at the end of the show. I tell you, injuries. Next thing you know, it's going to be Adam with an injury. Though I think the only injury he might get is in his hands from playing video games and gaming. Or maybe band. I think you can get injured in marching band. Maybe you trip on a trombone. I don't know. This week is going to be a really fun show. In science news, we're going to take a quick look at vaccines in the coronavirus saga. In dog science, we're going to take a look at dogs trying to rescue their humans who are in distress. And our expert guest is the amazing Dr. Noor Al-Mutasib. Her research is on addiction, withdrawal, and the neurons in the brain that control it all. Ha, that even rhymed. And as always, we've got some really fun trivia and some really cute stories about Bunsen in the family section. Hey Bunsen, do you know what a pirate scientist's favorite amino acid is? It's arginine. Arr. Okay, on with the show. Because there's no time like science time. This week in science news, let's chat a little bit about the story and a lot of the stories that are coming out about the coronavirus vaccine. Now, before we talk about the vaccine and the vaccine attempts and the vaccine process, let's talk a little bit of an update about the coronavirus. There is 78,000 cases and 2,363 deaths as of recording this. Now, that'll change by the time you listen to this podcast, because I always record a little bit early on the weekend when I've got some spare time. What's the mortality rate? Now, the mortality rate depends on where you are in the world. In China and Wuhan, it's about 5%. Other places in China, it's about 2%. Around the world, where there are other cases, it's less than 1%. The average is just over 2%. It's difficult, though, talking about that because people are very quick to say, you shouldn't talk about just taking the deaths and dividing it by the cases. There are a lot of people who are undiagnosed with coronavirus who may have died, and those aren't in the stats yet. Coronavirus still continues to spread without really a big sign of slowing. I mean, there are different graphs that show that after a big jump in how the Chinese government diagnosed it, it appears to be slowing. That may not be the case. Canada has got some people home who have been abroad that have been stuck due to the quarantine. And I know the United States as well. I think they scooped some people out of that that cruise ship that they were quarantined on. So on the vaccine front, there's a lot of different stories. I'm just going to focus on one. There's a company in San Diego called Inovio Pharmaceuticals, and they are working on their own vaccine because they worked on MERS and the MERS vaccine back in 2012. This company was one of the first to develop a vaccine for that disease. They were hoping that the new coronavirus was similar enough to their MERS vaccine for it to be useful and that there would be overlap, but that just wasn't the case. The two coronaviruses are just too different for a vaccine to work for one and then on the other. So when that failed, they just started from scratch developing a new vaccine. They're using the same process they used to develop the MERS vaccine. And you know what? I don't know a lot about how vaccines are made. So as I was like looking through the story, it was really interesting to me. In a traditional vaccine, the vaccine is comprised of weakened or killed viruses or chunks of the viruses, including like proteins. When you inject that into a person, your immune system recognizes it as an invader and springs into action, you know, sending out antibodies and then remembering it for future infections deep within your immune center. Vaccines, of course, can be made this way. The problem is, can you grow enough viruses to weaken and or kill to make enough for a million people? You can, but it's going to take a while, months or years. So these pharmaceutical companies have been working to solve a different way to make vaccines a little bit quicker. They take the virus's RNA and they convert it into DNA. And then they select pieces of the virus that will cause the immune system in humans to provoke, to make it have a response. And they select pieces using computer programs. The different pieces of the DNA, you still need to make tons of this stuff, right? So even if you're selecting chunks of it, how do you make tons of it? Well, you take that chunk of DNA, which is going to cause their immune response in people, and you put it into bacteria. The bacteria then take that DNA little chunk that you kind of crammed in there, and they spit out proteins, which then can be used in the vaccine. Most of the times, like if you're looking at the traditional length of a vaccine, it'll take you 2 to 3 years to make it. This process can make a vaccine in a couple hours and only about a month to manufacture it. So the company has their test vaccine ready to go, but you can't just jump right from test to humans. It's got to go through all of the different safety trials and animal trials. So they're going to begin their safety tests in February and then people in the summer. So while the amount of time has been cut drastically to make a vaccine for coronavirus, we're still a year away from it being commercially available or through, you know, Canada's healthcare system or wherever you are in the world to use, because it just takes that amount of time to make sure that it's safe and effective. This isn't the only company that is trying to beat the clock to get the vaccine out. Of course, they stand to make a lot of money from governments that want to buy it, but they also stand to potentially stop a really crazy outbreak. We're not sure when coronavirus will ever stop growing or spreading. Seems to still be contained relatively within China. Very few cases outside of China. Canada, the United States still have very, very few cases. If that changes, the demand for the vaccine and the race to make it will only go up. Anyways, I thought that was a really interesting kind of like deep dive into one company trying to make a vaccine for coronavirus. That's science news for this week. This week in dog science, we're going to take a look at a really cute study that has some really adorable conclusions about the bond between dogs and humans. Does anybody's dog out there or pet out there recognize when you're sad? Bunsen sure does. I occasionally get migraines. I think I've talked about that before. And when I'm really struggling with a migraine, I don't get them all the time. Like they're not like an every week thing, but when I get them and if I don't take care of them right away, they can get really bad. Bunsen definitely tries to cheer me up. He comes to cuddle with me on the bed and which is weird because he doesn't sleep on the bed with us. But if somebody is sick, he'll find them out. I'm not sure about distress, about crying, but he's really in tune with people if there's injury or sickness. I guess we could try this, what they did in the study with him, to see if he's good at that or not. So this was a fun study that I came across that was published last year in July in the Learning and Behavior Journal. What this study did was they took a bunch of different dogs, 34 different dogs, breeds, sizes, various shapes, various breeds. They had the pets and owners separated by a glass door that the dogs could easily open. And the owners had to do two tasks. One, they had to hum a nursery rhyme. I think it was Twinkle, Twinkle, Little Star. And they also had to cry and act distressed. What they found was the dogs, most of the dogs, regardless of what their humans were doing, wanted to be with their humans because their dogs like their humans. They pushed their way through the glass door to see their humans. What they found, though, was that the humans that were in distress, the humans that were crying, the dog opened the door to see their human on average about 40 seconds faster. The other thing was is that they monitored the dog's behavior. So when the human was just humming behind the glass door, the dogs were like, well, okay, I'll just come see you. They weren't stressed out at all. Their body language was completely unstressed. But when the humans were crying, the dogs, when they got through the door, were stressed out. They were like, what's going on? Are you okay? Oh my goodness. So they were acting completely different. Some dogs, though, who couldn't figure out the door and saw their human in distress, became paralyzed. They didn't know what to do. The scientists also, some of the dogs were completely indifferent to the humans' cries. Like they did not care. They did not care. Their humans were behind the glass door. They did not care. The humans were humming. And when the humans started to cry, they also did not care. I would hope that if I was behind a glass door and I started crying and Bunsen saw me, that he would be like, whoa, what's going on? And not just like totally ignore me like some of these dogs did. I think we've seen videos like that where an owner pretends to fall and the dog just kind of like continues on its way, like whatever, see you later, buddy. The researchers also talked about limitations of the study. In this section, we're going to get to another one another part of it that's really interesting. Was that the humans had a varying degree of their ability to act stressed out or distressed or cry. So some humans they felt were more convincing in how sad they were, whereas other humans were not as convincing and or were just bad at acting. And maybe the dogs picked up on their crappy acting and were like, oh, you're faking it. No way. So I thought that was really funny. The second part of the study with the dogs that were brought in and their humans was they devised something called the impossible task. So they set up this experiment so the dogs would be able to knock over this bowl and get a treat out of it. So they trained the dog to know that they could knock over this thing and a treat would come out of it quite easily. Then, unbeknownst to the dog, the researchers screwed a cap on this treat bowl so that when the dogs knocked it off, there was no way they could get the treat out of this like impossible to open for a dog thing. And then they wanted to see, would they seek out help from their owner? What would happen? And they found some really interesting conclusions. Before I talk about what happened when they got this impossible task, their humans were instructed to be in the same room with them, look straight ahead, and not make eye contact and ignore the dog. So while the dogs were easily able to get the treats, they really weren't really wanting to interact with their humans because there was like a nice treat in this bowl. What the researchers then looked at was when the task became impossible, which owner and which dog pair had different reactions. They found that the dogs that burst through the doors, the glass doors, to help out their crying humans had the most interactions with their human during the impossible task. So there must be something there, they concluded, about a bond between those dogs that would seek out to protect their owner, but then also want a reciprocal of help when they themselves were stuck. I thought that was really cute. Bunsen does that, I think. Like if he's got some kind of like toy that's not working for him, he brings it to us to try and get us to help him. Especially like his Kong. He has this Kong thing that he hucks on the ground and sometimes he'll bring it over and he's like, hey, I can't get the thing out. Other times he'll just like ignore us and try and solve his own problem. As an end to the study, the researcher, one of the main head researchers, Miners Mayer, said that dogs also have been shown in many studies to respond to crying of babies and crying of strangers. So they might be just cued to the tone of crying as well. It may not necessarily be 100% the bond between the dog and their human. It could be the sound of distress that they're cued to, not necessarily the sound of distress of their human. Anyways, I thought that was a really adorable study. I'm curious to try that with Bunsen and see what he would do. Like, if if he heard, if he saw one of us cry, like especially, I think if Chris was crying behind a glass door, Bunsen would burst through that door like the Kool-Aid man. Like, oh yeah! Like, do you want some help? And he's big enough to do that. Anyways, that's dog science for this week. Hey everybody, before we get to the interview section, I thought I'd tell you guys a little bit about how the podcast is made possible. It's made possible by listeners just like you. The people who support the show sign up on our Patreon page, and it's at patreon.com/Bunsenburner. There's four different tiers of support for how much you think you'd like to support the show. The lowest tier is only $5 a month. It's really only a couple cups of coffee. Now, I'm not saying take the coffee out of your diet to support the show, because I would go crazy without coffee. But if you really like the show and you like the content, please consider signing up at our Patreon page. You can sign up with a credit card or with PayPal, and then it's out of your mind. Every month, a small fee is thrown our way to help run the show. And we so appreciate our patron support. Thanks, guys. Back to the show. On the Science Podcast, we are really excited to have as our expert today, Dr. Noor Al-Muhtasib. How are you doing today, Noor?
Good. How are you?
I'm so good. Can you tell everybody where you're calling from in a general area, just so people get a picture where your voice is coming in from?
Yeah, New Haven, Connecticut.
Okay, that's cool.
Yeah.
And you had said you had some cold weather recently. We were just chatting about that.
Yeah. I mean, it's not as cold as up north, but it was felt like 3 degrees Fahrenheit yesterday. I don't know how that is in Celsius. But it was bad.
Cold anytime just makes things everything a little bit grosser. Yeah. Especially like if you don't have if you don't have snow coverage and it's just cold. I don't know. That's the worst for us.
Yeah, because there's no insulation.
Yeah, and it's the worst for us in Canada, because if there's no snow, like if we had a bad winter and there's no snow and it's just cold, you can't do anything. Like if there's lots of snow, you can go skiing and sledding and
there's fun.
Could you tell us a little bit about what your education is and maybe where you are at in your career and research? You have a really, really interesting area of study.
Well, yeah, thank you. So I got my bachelor's in science in biochemistry, bachelor's of science in biochemistry. And at the end of that, I knew I wanted to do something in science, but I wasn't sure exactly what, just because I didn't particularly enjoy the lab work we did. So I kind of applied to I did that thing where you apply to like 200 jobs and you hear back from two. And I heard back from one that rejected me completely, and one that offered me an interview and then eventually offered me the job. And it happened to be as a research assistant in a pharmacology program. And while I was there, I kind of learned that working in an academic setting made me realize I wanted to pursue academia, and that I wanted... I'm so sorry, my cat's meowing.
That's so cute. No, let's keep it. Yeah, it's awesome. We're going to talk about your cat later, I hope, right?
Yes, because he gets jealous when I talk to other people. and in particular, I realized I really like pharmacology, and which is the study... It's a mix of like the study of how the body, it's kind of like physiology, where it's like the study of how the body works and how we can develop medication to, combat diseases and how those medications work and how long they last. So then I did my PhD in that, and now I'm a postdoc in a molecular psychiatry program. And molecular psych is just psychiatry, but kind of looking more at the neurological underpinnings of neurological diseases. I mean, psychiatric diseases.
Okay, very cool. Now, so you pursued a science undergrad. Was there something that kind of bit you young with the science bug? Or was it kind of a slow burn? Like, was it all of a sudden like a light bulb went on? You're like, oh, I like science. Science is something I'm going to go into.
No, I think I always really liked science. It just was interesting to me. But then once I pursued my PhD, my mom started telling me stories about when I was younger, Because I would tell her about an experiment I did, and she would laugh and just be like, you know, you would ask these same questions when you were a child, right? And I was like, wait, what? And she's like, yeah, I mean, you would ask me, like, how does my medicine work? And I would just stare at you because I didn't know what the answer was. But I guess you picked the right field. And I think I was just asking these questions as a kid. Like, when I was sick, I remember being like, I wonder what's going on in my stomach. What's causing this cramp to happen? And that's kind of, you know, what physiology and pharmacology are. So I guess it was a slow burn.
There you go. No, it wasn't like you watched Osmosis Jones and you're like, wow, I need to figure out what these drugs are doing inside my body.
Yeah, no. It was just like this. I mean, definitely Magic School Bus probably contributed.
Oh, I love the Magic School Bus.
It's so good.
Yeah. Yeah, Miss Frizzle is a hero.
She is. Have you seen the updated version?
I have not, but even some of my high school kids are tell me about, like, because I'm a high school chemistry teacher.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And some of my students are like, you need to watch. Some of them watch the Magic School Bus. They just love it.
It's I watched it, and like they talk about CRISPR, which is like this really high, like, you know, it's this new technique. And I'm just like, how do these kids know about CRISPR? But I guess that's how it is.
That's so good for science communication, though. Like we need the next generation coming up is going to have to. CRISPR is going to, like, if CRISPR. I mean, I don't want to derail the conversation and talk about CRISPR, but that is like, if CRISPR becomes a thing 20 years from now, that the generations coming up are going to have to wrestle with some pretty serious conversations around gene editing.
For sure.
So maybe that they're just hedging the future.
Yeah, they're just getting them ready.
Yeah, they're getting them ready. There you go. So your research right now is focusing on like drug reward and withdrawal in mice. Is that kind of correct, or could in rats? Yeah, oh, I'm so sorry.
Mm-hmm. No.
Okay, so that's the animal side of it. How if somebody's listening, how could you scale that up to the like a human analogy? Why is that so important? Sure. For us humans?
Yeah, of course. So the way we are studying the drug reward and withdrawal in rats is that we train the rats to press a lever to receive a drug IV administration. And then we remove the drug such that when they press the lever, they're not receiving the drug anymore. And that's like the withdrawal period. So that's kind of our experimental paradigm. And I do want to just like add just a thing about how we have very strict protocols and how we treat our animals. Just as a pet owner, you know, I care a lot about animals, and I also care a lot about my animals at work. And I know I feel like we get this like bad scientist rep, like this evil scientist that's just, you know, messing around with the animals. So I just wanted to add that little thing in there.
No, that's really important. I get that too. Like I've never done research at your level, but we had rats in my degree, and they were treated like pets almost, like extremely.
Yeah.
You treat them with the absolute most respect. Mm-hmm. So that, thank you for saying that. That's good.
It might
as we talk about this, it's important research. But mm-hmm. people have misgivings, of course, and maybe this might alleviate some of that.
Hopefully, So during withdrawal from a drug and afterwards, several things can cause like a person to pursue the drug again or to relapse. And that includes taking the drug itself. You know, someone says like, oh, they fell off the wagon. And then usually that causes them to take the drug again and again. The other is a cue or something that reminds them of the drug. So in our experiments, that's the lever for the rats. They see the lever and they're like, oh, if I press this, I'll get my drug. But for, you know, if we scale it to the human setting, it can be a lot of things. Like it can be seeing a bar or going to a bar. It can be seeing the person like you grab a smoke with, or it could be it depends on what drug it was. Anything that reminds you of the drug is considered a cue. And that can induce relapse in someone. And that can happen even years after someone has stopped taking the drug. when they're like essentially, you know, recovered from withdrawal, which is really heartbreaking, but really shows how much of a disease addiction can be. So what we're trying to understand is the neurological underpinnings. So what's going on in our brain that causes this relapse, this particular form of relapse, in order to maybe develop a medication to target it, in hopes of assisting those with substance use disorders.
Right. And this is a serious topic. There's probably people listening who either maybe have gone through substance abuse, family members who are suffering. Mm-hmm. And folks like you are on this. Like, there is researchers around the world trying their best to, you know, find multiple pathways to success for people getting off those drugs. That's really interesting. Is there anything you can tell us about from your research so far that's kind of interesting, that you found?
We do. Actually, our lab did recently find that so during withdrawal, there are increases in anxiety-like and depressive-like behaviors in rats, which can be seen in also in humans. So we are trying to target it. We found that one particular protein might be involved in these behaviors. So what my work is going to do is trying to understand how this protein has been changed, and how involved is it in these behaviors. So because maybe the relapse, because we don't know, is the relapse due to behaviors like being feeling anxious and depressed like, and someone seeks the drug, or is it something else, or is it a mix of these things? So we're trying to understand a little bit more about this protein.
Wow, that's really powerful, right? Every tool that somebody has is just one more way to get
exactly
to success.
Yeah, it's just really, it's so complicated.
That's good. That's a great point. It is very complicated. Yeah. Speaking of complications and things that are very complicated, the brain, right? The brain is super complicated. And the reward center of the brain through drug use is also very, very complicated. Mm-hmm. A lot of people maybe don't have like even high school level biology and are really confused by some of the terms that people use.
Yeah.
And one of them is like basically how, you know, the neurons and how that works in the brain. Mm-hmm. Could you give us like a Cole's notes of that? Like a recap of that area of biology?
For sure. Yeah. So it is complicated, but it can also be simplified. So my 5-year-old niece came to my defense and she was coloring for the most part, but I had talked to her a little bit about what I was going to talk about. And like certain parts, she would like turn down like to her mother and whisper and be like, I know what she's talking about. so it can, you know, it can be understood. hopefully if I explain it correctly. So the neurons in our brain talk to each other to convey information, which allows us to move or remember stuff and basically do anything. And the message starts as an electrical signal in, let's say, neuron A, and that travels down the neuron. And this electrical signal is known as an actual potential. And if you've ever heard that, that's what it is. It's basically it's literally an electrical signal like you would have in a wire. And once it reaches the end of neuron A, there's a gap between neuron A and neuron B. And that's known as a synapse. And right there, the message is transformed into a chemical one. The electrical signal in neuron A allows for these chemicals to be released from neuron A, and they're called neurotransmitters, such as, dopamine, the ones we've heard, you might have heard about, you know, the like hot ones. And then these chemicals go and act on neuron B, which elicits an action potential, aka an electrical signal, which travels down neuron B, and the story goes on. And it keeps going on until it leads to an action, like moving your hand or stopping moving or speaking or stopping to speak.
So for people that are listening, that's something that's really interesting and also confusing, is that it goes from like an electrical signal to chemical back to electrical. And that's happening all the time. Is that correct? Did I break that down right from what you said?
Exactly. It's like electrical, chemical.
So how do drugs factor into the signal pathway?
They each act differently. But typically when we think about drugs of addiction, it's that they increase dopamine release. So they're increasing the chemical signal part, which is, you know, so dopamine is thought to be the happy neurotransmitter, which is not completely true, but it does definitely play into addiction. But all of these drug of addiction, no matter what they act on, eventually lead to increased dopamine release or an increase of that dopamine chemical signaling.
Gotcha. And then that's where the dependency comes from.
Yeah, that's where it starts. Well, dependency is a little bit different than addiction. Yeah. So dependency is more of the physiological, like the body's dependence on the drug. And that happens because, so for example, whenever your body has like a homeostasis, it has a way that it's set, you know, and it's good. Once you introduce a drug, the drug starts to change the tone, and it might increase certain parts of the tone and decrease other certain parts. So when you take the drug away, you no longer have the drug maintaining its new tone. So that, like, you feel uncomfortable, and that's the dependence, and that's what leads to withdrawal. Whereas addiction is a little more, addiction's a little more complicated in the sense of it's thought there are changes in neurological pathways in the brain, the way that neurons are connected to each other. Because our neurons, the more that neurons talk to each other, the stronger the connection becomes. And the less they talk to each other, the weaker that connection becomes. Yeah, so that's where addiction comes in, and where someone becomes like, learns to just want to pursue that drug. So addiction and dependence are slightly different. So that's why someone.
So if we so if we think of this like a railroad, it's like if you've taken a drug, you've changed like the pathway the railroad will go. Like you've changed the track
slightly. Yeah, and then, exactly.
Yeah, you might have slightly changed it, and then inside the cabin, the temperatures may be a little bit different. Mm-hmm. So if you don't take the drug, then you feel uncomfortable because you're used to a certain temperature in the train.
Yep.
And not only so the train is now on a different track, and the temperature is the wrong temperature. So
exactly.
It gets very, very complicated very quickly, kind of thing.
Exactly. And, you know, you can eventually get the temperature back to normal. You can get someone through withdrawal, but the train is still on the wrong track.
Oh, okay.
You still have that issue. And that's where like a lot of researchers are putting their work into of, all right, once we get someone past withdrawal, like what can we do? Because, you know, if you talk to a lot of people who are, you know, recovering, like they'll often say they're recovering alcoholics, but they'll like never step into a bar again in their life because it's just not a risk they want to take. And it feels like a lifelong illness. And it is. And that's not what I want it to be anymore. Obviously, I can't change it just as one person, but that's what a lot of researchers are trying to do.
Gotcha. Very cool. Very important work. Well, thank you for sharing about that. It's a very interesting area of research.
Thanks.
Okay, so that's a really heavy topic. It's an important topic. Let's bring things a little more fluffy and fun. And we always ask our guests kind of in the middle for a pet story. This is the podcast, PAWD.
I love it.
We talk about Bunsen every day on the podcast, and we always ask our guests to share a pet story. Do you have one you could share with us?
Yes. I was trying so hard to think of which one to share because I have so many of him.
I know they're so hard. We love them so much, our pets, and they're just, you know.
So I have a cat named Nimr, which means tiger in Arabic. And I think it's from a lot of people who follow me on Twitter, this is going to be first time they actually hear the pronunciation of his name. So that's how you say his name. But so we like to watch, like, you know, those big show, the big cat shows where they show big cats hunting or like doing things. Yeah, so he likes to sit with me and watch these shows. And he is following along because you can see his ears moving and his tail twitches. And like, you know, if the big cat's about to grab the whatever they are hunting, he'll like sit up and like get really excited. And I don't know if he knows what's going on, but it feels like he does.
So do you think he's like, they're like his heroes? They're like the big cat heroes he looks up to?
I think so, because he also got the same way when I was watching Black Panther. Like as soon as he saw like that scene where the panthers were sitting on the tree, he really got into the movie.
And they definitely made the hero move like a cat too. So I wonder if he picked up on that too. That's cool.
So he probably thinks he's a little Black Panther.
That's cute. The you know, house cats are, they're murder floofs, right?
They are. As I was telling the story, he was like attacking my hand nicely.
Oh, really?
Attacking it.
How long have you had, is it, can you say the name again? Nimid?
Yeah, exactly. Perfect. Mm-hmm.
How long have you had Nimid?
Around 3 years.
Okay.
Yeah. I adopted him when he was a little less than a year old. I was babysitting him for someone, actually. And then the person was like, oh, I have to give him away. Can you keep him till like someone, you know, decides to like adopt him? And I was like, sure. And then like the person who was supposed to adopt him was like, oh, I'll come pick him up tonight. And I was like, no.
He took a piece of your heart by then.
Hey? Yeah. And my friend was like, I mean, obviously I want you to have him because he's been with you for like months at this point. But yeah,
that's what I always tell people, like if that's why I don't think I could ever be like a boarder for dogs. I would just have like 1,000 dogs, right? Like I just keep everyone.
I know,
like, hey, can you keep this dog for 3 months? And the back of my mind is like, yeah,
forever.
But then after a month it'd be like, I think that he can just be Bunsen's friend now. We'll just keep this dog.
Yeah. Like, no, I just can't do that to him, you know?
Yeah. Well, thank you for sharing that story. That's pretty cute. Okay. Cats are awesome.
Yeah.
My wife and my youngest son, they just love cats. I'm unfortunately really allergic to them. So we're just waiting for science to make some miracle thing to stop that. So I guess that I could just take Reactine every day, but that's not.
Yeah. I love all animals. Like I'll be walking down the street and I'll see a dog and I'll just start crying. I don't know why that's my reaction. When I see pets, I cry. It's just a like innate reaction. But it's just, they're so cute.
Yeah, they're just pure. They're the best.
They're so excited to see you.
You know, there's the research, speaking of the brain and reward and dopamine, like a lot of people do have such a positive reaction to pets.
The evidence is
overwhelming that if you have a pet or if you're feeling, it's not a cure for depression, obviously, but it can help improve your mood
being
around animals, which is really cool.
I actually, I've been doing some like dialectical behavioral therapy. And part of it is mindfulness, and where you know, as the word, it's like mindfulness. So I actually use Nimid a lot. And like, if I'm having like starting to kind of really feel anxious, I'll like pick him up and I'll hold him and I'll be like, all right, you know, he feels soft and he feels warm. And I was like, and then I can hear him purring because you're trying to activate all 5 senses. I mean, I don't lick him, obviously.
But he might lick you.
I know, right? So he licks me, but like, you know, I'll smell him and he smells good. And I'm like, it's like a really good mindfulness exercise. So yeah, you can actually use them in a therapeutic benefit.
That's cool. I've mentioned it before on the podcast, but my high school has, during exams, they have a dog room. They bring in a couple accredited therapy dogs. Then they bend the rules for me to bring Bunsen in. He's not accredited therapy dogs, but the kids love him so much. And I definitely think it does help them. They come in and they play with him and pet with him and they go off and write their test. And I can't imagine how much better I would have done in high school if I could go see a fluffy dog.
I know, me too. It would definitely like calm me down.
Yeah, or you know, at least decrease your stress and anxiety for sure.
Exactly.
Yeah. Pets, hey? Great.
Yes, I know, right?
Well, speaking of something that maybe you're also really passionate about, on your Twitter feed and in your bio and your website, you talk about how you're really passionate about making science an inclusive space.
Mm-hmm.
Could you speak about that? Like, why are you so passionate?
You know, I'm not entirely sure why I am. I don't know if it's because of my experiences or the experiences of people I loved. I mean, I think also just our world is so diverse. I don't know how it can function other than being inclusive, you know, just on the surface of that. But also, I think in order for science to flourish, in order for anything to flourish, it needs a diverse set of voices. And the only way to have that set of voices is to be inclusive. And like I said, in general, I think being inclusive makes for a better world. As you know, we're made up of different people, and it should be designed to accommodate them. And that's just plain and simple, in my opinion. And it's really not that hard. Also, I think, like, you know, recently during my research, like, I'm studying, like, this Q&D relapse, and I read about these papers about how, like, I was saying, you know, how a bar or an alcoholic beverage can be a trigger for someone who's recovering. And then I think about all these networking events in science that are held in bars and are predominantly alcohol-based events, and, like, how they're excluding a set of people. And how that's one way, and, like, I've talked about this on Twitter before, and it's like, that's just even more ways that we are excluding people. And something small, we could, like, you know, coffee shops exist. You know, you can have, like, a coffee morning and be or like a coffee chat and still have, like, a networking event, but it includes people. So I think it's a mix of actually my science and my lived experiences.
That's a really good point about the networking for science. I'm just thinking now, I'm like, my own experience, like, I present at teachers' conventions, and they usually mm-hmm. have, like, a get together at night, and it is,
yeah,
you know, there is alcohol there. It's not in a bar, but that would be for somebody who has gotten through that, and that's a trigger for them. They would stay away from that mm-hmm. like crazy, and then they would exclude them.
Yeah, exactly.
An early morning mixer with coffee would be amazing. That would include everybody.
Exactly.
And if you don't want coffee, there's tea, and if you know, there's mm-hmm. could be apple juice or whatever.
Yeah. Exactly.
And you could throw in some dogs and cats, but maybe not, because some people are allergic. So maybe that would
be in, like, the neighboring room for those who do want to see them.
There you go. Well, thanks for sharing that. That's great. Yeah. When many voices are heard, many more, you know, you have more diversity. Mm-hmm. I think it's like when you roll the dice, you have mm-hmm. a greater chance of having different roles when, you know, you have more numbers on the dice.
Yeah, exactly.
And I think science needs that. They need voices. They need all of the numbers.
I agree.
All of the numbers.
Mm-hmm.
I talk to my high school kids about that all the time. I'm like, you know, if you look 200 years ago, like, women weren't allowed to do virtually anything in science or math mm-hmm. or really anything. Like, it was a really sexist system back there.
Yeah.
And you eliminated 50% of the population from having any kind of input or any kind of advancement. And just think what, I mean, things aren't as great today as they could be.
Mm-hmm.
With that, of course, it's better than it was 200 years ago. We still have improvements, obviously, to make.
Exactly.
But when you just think of all of those voices that were silenced and not mm-hmm. given an opportunity to share their knowledge, just how far ahead our society would be. Mm-hmm. And I think that when I tell them that, like, the light bulbs go on and they're like, oh, yeah.
Yeah. If you look at, like, I mean, how many studies have you heard about, you know, it being conducted, you know, a long time ago, purely by men, and, you know, something minor went wrong, and it had to do with the fact they didn't take into consideration that, like, a menstrual cycle, for example. And,
so frustrating.
Yeah, and it's like, easily a woman could have looked at that and been like,
hey, guys.
Yes, exactly. Or even if you look at, like, I talked to my friends in med school, and, like, you know, how their med students are particularly trained, for example, to look at how diseases look on white bodies. So when they go in the clinic, that's what they look for. So sometimes they miss how it looks like on like brown and black bodies, because that's not what they're trained to see. And like, so even at that level, like, how can we train students in a way that like makes them better doctors? And that's really been interesting to me.
Yeah. And having a conversation helps. That's great. So
exactly.
Thanks for having that conversation with me.
Thank you for giving me the opportunity. Yeah.
One thing that's also really fun that you talk about on Twitter, and maybe you can speak about, is one of your creative outlets is poetry.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's super important for everybody to have some kind of like creative output.
Yeah,
and it can be whatever, right? Like my creative output is extremely weird to the average person. I build costumes. I build cosplay costumes.
Oh, that's awesome. That's really cool.
So it's I enjoy it. It's a huge stress relief for me.
Mm-hmm.
And I saw that you read poetry, you write poetry, and I just wanted to talk to you about that. That's really cool.
Thanks.
What do you do with that for your creative outlet?
Well, I started writing when I was really young. Obviously, when I was young, I was like writing about this like deep love that I had no idea what it was like about, but. You know, when you're a kid. It's just, you know, a way to put my emotions into words be able to just like put it out there. And sometimes it feels like a good release. Did that answer the question? Sorry, I wasn't.
Yeah, no, that it's a very deep question. And I was just going to say, I think anybody with a hobby that they put their heart and soul in, if you put your emotions into poetry, it's kind of like somebody who is a gardener and they put their emotions into their garden, and you can see the passion in what they do, and it could be anything.
Exactly.
It could be anything. That's cool. Do you have some favorite poets or poems that you go back to?
Yeah.
I would be interested. I don't know much about poetry, but I saw that and it was really cool.
So I have one friend that I really like. I have her Twitter handle. Yeah. So it's IDABWELLIN. I really like her work. But also in general, so Arabic actually has a really rich history in poetry. Like there are a lot of Arab poets. I don't know if I could like really recall any, and it's really hard to translate it into English because part of what makes it beautiful is like how it rhymes in Arabic.
Right.
But I think
the symbols are just so gorgeous too.
I know.
Like the Arabic symbols.
Yeah.
I have Arabic kids, and they'll write like, "Hello, Mr. Zakowski," and it just,
I know.
It looks like art. It looks like art. Like they're just blown
away. It's so easy for us, but like everybody who sees it is like, "Oh my gosh, it's so beautiful." And I'm like, "Yeah, thank you."
I'm sorry, I'm not patronizing you at all. With
no, that. I know. It's like I used to love it as a kid. Like it was, I still do it now. It is beautiful. I don't know how to do calligraphy though. I should definitely take a class because it, like, some of the stuff I see is just so insanely pretty, and like it's an art of its own.
De-stress through that as well, like maybe reading and writing your own poetry, or reading other people's poetry.
I think it's very validating when you read someone else's poems that are discussing feelings you have or experiences you have. It makes you feel less alone.
Well, thank you for sharing. Hopefully that wasn't too personal a question.
No.
It was just such a cool little note in your bio. I just wanted to ask you about it.
Yeah, of course.
We always ask our guests for a super fact. Do you have a super fact you could share with us?
Yes. So one thing I find really awesome, or I guess interesting, is that the neurons aren't actually the majority of the cells in the brain. It's actually 50-50 glial cells, and 50% glial cells and 50% neurons, which I find pretty cool.
What's a glial cell?
Glial cells have several roles. They help maintain the homeostasis in the brain. They also myelinate neurons. And they help protect neurons as well. So they are kind of like a checks and balances type of cell in the brain. They just don't have any electrical transmission.
Very cool.
Yeah.
And that's something that most people don't know. I didn't know that I just thought your brain was full of neurons.
Yeah. And I mean, it has around, I think, like 86 billion neurons and around 85 billion glial cells. So it's actually really close. And estimates before that actually had it
that it was made up more of glial cells than neurons, which is even wilder.
85 billion and 85 billion. So
yeah,
like
basically.
170 billion. That's crazy.
I know. Yeah, and it's like how our bodies are made up of more E. coli than our own cells. I don't know if that's fully percent true, but I remember learning that in school. That was also weird.
I've heard that. We're just like swimming in bacteria.
Yeah.
And our brains are full of different types of cells and we're swimming in bacteria.
Yeah. And like, you know, if you talk to people who study glial cells, I know some people get a little salty because, you know, neurons get all the tensions, but glial cells do some awesome things and should get a decent amount of attention since they make up 50% of the brain.
Yeah.
So I understand the saltiness.
I see. They're probably, and you yourself are probably just as salty when people are saying, hey, you know what? What if we used 100% of our brain? Just think how amazing yeah. we'd be. Do you get that? It makes you crazy.
Oh my God. Yes. Yeah, we do. When I was trying to think of like a super fact, I was like, the 10% one, I think is pretty hopefully well known by now. But limitless.
No, like I get it from kids all the time. Sometimes in tongue in cheek, like high school kids, sometimes tongue in cheek. Yeah. They're like, what if you use 90% instead of 50, like teasing, you know, somebody who's done something silly. But then there is a lot of misconception out there that, you know, what if we could just use 100%, we could levitate stuff and, you know, we would solve all the mysteries of the world.
And like fix everything. Yeah. A third of the neurons in the brain are located in the cerebellum, which is a pretty small region in the brain to like house a third of the neurons.
That's insane.
That was
I can't do the math quickly. What, third of 85, but something like 20, 28 or something. I don't know. Don't quote me on that. I'm very bad at that. That is anyways, whatever the math is, that is a lot of neurons.
It is. Yeah. In a very densely packed area.
So cool.
Yeah.
Well, thanks for sharing that super fact. That's amazing. The brain, hey, just the brain is crazy.
I know. That's why I love it.
We're at the end of the interview. Thank you so much for talking to us about the brain and your really important research with reward and withdrawal with a rat, sorry, and how that may be scaled up to humans.
Yeah.
That's a really, really deep and important subject with families and people that might be going through that. And there's a lot of hope. There's researchers like yourself that are working on as many different pathways to success as possible. So that's great.
Thank you so much for having me.
Oh, no problem. Where can people find you on social media?
My Twitter handle is Neuronal. So it's Neuronal. It's a play of my name and neurons.
I love it.
Yeah. Thank you.
That's great. Is there any other accounts or causes you'd like to get the word out about before we close the interview?
Yeah, there are like three accounts that I follow that are pretty awesome people that I find to be very that speak a lot about important issues and are creative people. So there's Claudia, who I don't know if you follow. She's like CA_AstroCom. She's one of the most positive people I know, and she's constantly supporting everyone. So I recommend her. One of my
friends. Is that Antonelli, Dr. Claudia Antonelli? Oh, I love her. She's so good.
She is.
I have interviewed her already. She's going to be a guest on the podcast.
That's
great. She's so good.
And there's my friend Jay. So it's Jaye. Purview, and she's a comic and a scientist. She's also an if-then ambassador, which is awesome. So she's having like a wax statue made of her, which is amazing. She's been drawing all the pictures for Unique, also a scientist, or the Unique Scientists. So if you've seen any of those like cards, that's been her. So I definitely recommend following her if you're into science and into art. And my last person is, they don't have their name on their Twitter, Satirony. They talk a lot about issues about being Black in society, being a Black man in society, and just a minority in science.
Having a different experience than the majority, perhaps.
Talks a lot about important issues that I like. So I recommend them.
That's great. Thanks for sharing those accounts.
Yeah, of course. Thank you.
All right. Well, you know, thank you one more time. I so appreciate you coming on the podcast and giving us your knowledge and talking about your cat.
Thank you.
we'll make sure we get some people going your way. I'm sure some people will check out you just to maybe see if they can snag a picture of your cat.
Yeah. No, I definitely
we got a lot. You got some pictures of cats on Twitter. That's great. Yeah. Your cat on Twitter. That's great. Have a great day and take care.
All right. You too. Thank you.
Hey, everybody. I just want to give a quick shout out to our sponsor, Genius Lab Gear. Genius Lab Gear is giving everybody 10% off everything at their store if you use the code BUNSEN10. That's BUNSEN10. Genius Lab Gear has a ton of cool stuff. We love that they sent Bunsen a bandana that says PhD Emotional Support Dog. It's so cute. Also, they have these little wallet-sized stencils for doing organic molecules. And if you're not a scientist or a science teacher, there's gear at the site that you would like as well, including Science is for Everyone stickers and a whole bunch of other stuff. Check them out. That's at geniuslabgear.com. It's time for Woo or Wow on the podcast. And on Woo or Wow, if this is the first time you're listening to the podcast, I will be reading three different statements. Two of them are fake and one of them is true. And I have a guest host again this week to try and figure out which is the true statement among the other two fake statements. I have Graham Walton. How are you doing today, Graham?
I'm doing fantastic. How are you?
I'm so good. So Graham, how do you know me? What's our relationship?
We're fortunate enough to teach at the exact same school in the same department and the same discipline of that department.
Right. So I've got another chem guy with me here. I figured I'd start with the chem guys, and I've got a bio person coming up later as one of the other guest hosts, but Graham's another chem teacher at the school.
The chem people are more superstars, so that's why.
Well, we'll see. On purpose, the category is the brain, so I picked a bio. So ready for the three statements?
Ready as I'll ever be.
Okay, so again, only one of these statements is true. Gotcha. The other two are like crazy fake.
Perfect.
Okay, so you might have to listen to all three before you make your decision.
Yeah.
Okay, here's the first statement. Your brain uses 20% of the total oxygen your body takes in. The only organ that uses more is your liver.
That's the first statement?
Yeah.
Okay. That so far sounds false, but that's okay.
Okay. You want to hear the next one?
Yeah.
Here's the second statement. Neurons in your brain move information at crazy high speeds. The fastest neuron has been measured to be moving information at 750 miles per hour, which is the speed of sound. And for the Canadians and the rest of the world that use the metric system, that's 1,200 kilometers an hour.
I would say that sounds kind of true, but I have no idea.
Yeah, but neurotransmitters are chemicals, though, Graham.
Yeah, but it's an electromotive force, isn't it?
Yeah.
Okay.
Do you want to hear the third one?
Yes, please.
Okay, and the third statement is the largest your brain will ever be is when you're a teenager. It starts shrinking shortly after puberty.
I want that not to be true, so I'm going to say that's false.
Okay, so remember, there's two false statements.
Yep.
And one true statement.
I think the statement that's true is the one about the electrical impulses in your brain.
The speed?
Yeah, I think that's true.
Okay, so you think the woo one is the oxygen one, and the woo one is the brain shrinking one.
Correct. Yes.
Okay. Final answer?
Yeah. Sure.
Okay. So we'll start with the one that you said was woo right off the bat about your brain being the smallest in your starting to shrink after your teenage years.
Yeah.
That one is not correct. So you got that one right.
Woo!
Right. Your brain actually starts shrinking about when you're in your middle ages. So about me right now.
Oh, so it's about to shrink.
Yeah, it's about to shrink for you, and it's already shrinking for me.
Perfect.
And all our students still have the big brains, even though maybe sometimes not.
Not all of them.
Not all of them.
Yeah.
Well, we love them, though.
Yeah.
So that leaves two statements left. The one statement was about the oxygen, and the other statement was about the speeds. So let's look at the one you thought was the true statement.
Yeah.
That's the speed statement.
Yep.
Neurons, the fastest the neurons have ever been measured is not 750. That's way too fast.
Okay.
The fastest speed is 250 miles per hour, or 402 kilometers an hour.
That's still crazy fast.
That is ridiculously fast. Yeah.
Okay.
So not the speed of sound.
All right.
I pumped that up a bit. Your brain, the true statement is your brain does use roughly 20% of the oxygen your body takes in, and your liver uses more.
See, I knew your brain used a lot,
yeah,
but I was not expecting the liver to use that much.
Yeah, and that's why I picked it. I didn't know that either when I was researching this to screw you over and trick you.
That's pretty cool.
Okay, thanks, Graham.
Okay.
Okay, everybody, it's time for Wacky Wisdom with me, Adam. So today, we are going to be talking about some wacky wisdom that we've all as a family picked up about dogs. Because, like last podcast, we couldn't think of any stories or any questions in time. All right, Mom, is there any wisdom that you picked up about dogs along this wacky journey that we've had?
It has been a really fun journey with Bunsen, but I'm very grateful that we went early for dog training. That was really, really important for us to get out of the way. Our other golden retriever, we had a golden retriever, and she picked up some bad habits because we didn't know what we were doing. And so this time around, we were very focused on socializing the dog because we had read about the super stats of the puppies, and the Bernese Mountain Dog definitely showed that it needed socialization with other dogs and humans. Because it's an aggressive breed at all, it's because they're so shy, and we wanted to make sure that we had the opportunity to make our dog the best dog that he could be, and I'm really grateful for that and getting that knowledge just to make sure that any kind of bad habits that he might have picked up, that we were able to deal with those effectively.
Anyway, some wisdom that I've picked up, even though I'm not that old and I shouldn't be giving out wisdom, but some wisdom that I've picked up is that you need a good dog for your family. So our family is like, we're fun and yay, you know? But we also like to kick back and relax sometimes. And Bunsen's that way too. He wants exercise right when we come home, and then after that he's just super chill and is a couch potato. All right? So just make sure that you have a good dog for you. Like if you're an active person, get an active dog. If you're a not-so-active person, get a St. Bernard. I don't know, man. I don't know what to call them, but they're like super lazy. Dad, what about some wisdom that you've picked up?
Well, the one thing I'll say is that from having a dog before Bunsen, who got older and then sadly was diagnosed with cancer, is you have to be really careful with your dog's health. We did everything right with our Golden before Bunsen. It wasn't really anybody's fault. She was just older. But it costs a lot of money when your dog gets older for health issues. So you either have to think about setting money aside every month or paying premiums for health insurance. That way, when something comes along, you don't have to make a financial decision to keep the health of your dog up there. So you don't have to make a very, very painful decision between money and the health of your dog. For Bunsen, we decided against healthcare for him. Like you can get different types of healthcare where you pay monthly premiums. We decided to put money away every month into a Bunsen savings account. So if something major ever comes along, there will be a pool of money that we can draw from. I think that's really important because anything with dogs is expensive. The irony is that when Bunsen was a puppy, he broke his toe.
Yeah.
And we didn't have any money really saved in the Bunsen account. So I guess maybe if we had the insurance, it would have been a better idea. But since Bunsen broke his toe when he was a puppy till now, he's been incredibly healthy. Like there's been really nothing. He puked a few times, but
that's normal.
Yeah. So I'd say just health. Take your dog in for regular vet checks. Make sure Adam's right. Make sure the dog is right for your family. And Chris is right. Make sure you train your dog, but also make sure you can afford your animal. Dogs are expensive. They're not cheap. And large breed dogs, people ask all the time about Bunsen. He's a large breed dog. He eats a ton of food and
He's expensive. We love him, and we're lucky enough to be able to afford him. But make sure you are financially, stable enough to be able to afford an animal and their health care when they get older, because older dogs and older animals cost a lot of money. That's my wisdom.
Wow, that's a lot of wisdom. Thank you for sharing that. It's really important to connect with people too, with other dog owners. Anyway, having a dog allows you to get out of the house and out into the community and connecting with people, which is very, very important as well.
Anyway, that's been Wacky Wisdom, and I hope I see you next time for whatever we decide to do next, because I don't know at this point. It's been a roller coaster the past week. You know, busy, not busy, busy, not busy. Maybe next week I might be eating a sandwich for 30 minutes. You don't know. I'll see you next time, and I hope you've had fun. See ya.
We've come to the end of another podcast episode. Thanks so much for listening. Special thanks to Dr. Noor Al-Mutasib, who talked to us about brain chemistry, brain facts, addiction, her cat, and poetry. That was such a fun interview. I'd like to give a quick shout out to the patrons on our Patreon page who make the podcast possible. Our top tier patrons get a shout out. They are Andrea Persons, Bianca Hyde, Brooke Lavallo, Carmen Presidio, Daniel Fry, Elizabeth Bourgeois, Judith Morton, Karen Beth St. George, Catherine Lynch, Kathleen Zerker, Mary Coos, Marianne McNally, Ben Rathert, Liz Button, and Rebecca Rutherford. Thanks so much, patrons. Thanks to your support, it just keeps going and it keeps growing. Next week, we have a rocket propulsion expert, our rocket scientist, who's going to be talking to us about all things rockets and getting them into outer space. I can't wait to share the interview with you. But for now, we have to say goodbye. So let's end with Bunsen's motto for science, empathy, and cuteness.